No matter how many times you hear that scripture verse, and then on the first day of the week, while it was still dark, cometh Mary unto the sepulchre. And there she found the stone rolled away, and she ran back to tell the other disciples, Simon Peter, and the way St. John writes it, St. Simon Peter and the other disciple whom Jesus loved. That's how John always referred to himself. He never uses his own name when he writes the gospel, but he's too humble to use his name, but he's too truthful not to describe himself as he was. He was the disciple that Jesus loved. He didn't say he was the only disciple that Jesus loved, but he always referred to himself in those words. It's really quite remarkable when you think about it, because when we use our name, we're defining ourselves by the reality that we ourselves have assumed. Our parents give us a name, or some of us in spiritual life take on a new identity with a new name. And then ever thereafter, people call us that. That's how we think of ourselves. All these associations build up with the sound of that name. I've shared with you all, and some of you tease me about it now, of a wonderful dream I had in which I died. I was actually had my head chopped off by a good friend of mine who seemed to have the divine role of being my executioner, and he had one of those big axes that were carved like this, and he actually lifted up the axe, and there was this great rapport between the two of us. I'm sorry to have to do this. Oh, I understand. It's just your role. You know, very unusual. And then just before the axe fell, I was very relaxed in this death dream. I believe it had a touch of superconsciousness, at least. I was very relaxed, but just in the last second, this anxiety, you know, over the body comes. Ooh, this is going to hurt. That just crossed my mind for the first time. And then I remembered Master's promise that when the soul is about to exit the body, the soul knows it, and it just basically doesn't stay around for the moment of impact. Many people who are in car accidents and things like that will tell you that they see the car coming together and then they're floating above. And of course, they come back and tell us about it, but souls that exit, it's a comforting thought when you think of people who die suddenly, that they don't hang around. Why should I? Like it's over here, I'm done. So I had that thought just before my friend dropped the axe on my head. And then I exited upward, and it was beautiful in the dream. But the relevant part of this was, as I was leaving, what I said, and just like a little child, was, bye-bye, Asha, just like that, bye-bye. And her little body got smaller and smaller, and I went out like this, bigger and bigger, and it was just so long to that whole story called me. You know, the self was still there, the consciousness was still there, that which I really call myself. We can't really get rid of the ego just by killing the body. Basically, the answer to that is no such luck. You know, it's just not that easy. The ego, the body exists because the ego pre-exists the body. In the astral world, the energy self is identified with this separate reality. But now here is John. And John is this deeply devoted disciple of Christ. And his entire self has become that he was the disciple whom Jesus loved. Now the whole goal of the spiritual path can really be defined in the simplest possible terms. The ego and all of our karma makes it seem very complex, but it isn't complex. It's simply this. We are falsely defined by the temporary reality created by incarnating in a physical body, whereas our true nature, our infinite nature, our source, our everlasting being, is infinite in nature and one with the infinite. But as I said, just killing the body isn't enough to teach us that. We have to gradually overcome all these incarnations of habit. Even just one lifetime of habit is a great deal. Just to let go of all the realities that we call ourselves. A friend of mine passed away from cancer, and another friend told me that when she was dying and her family was around her, she had a husband and a beautiful home and friends, But she was very exalted in her consciousness, and she was lying on her deathbed, and she articulated in her last hours, she said thousands of faces kept passing in front of her, and every face that she saw, she knew had been her own face in one incarnation or another. And she sort of looked to her friend and said, how can I cling to this particular face that I have. She was so free in her consciousness that, you know, people are so silly. She was a couple of weeks away from dying, and we all knew it, and someone complimented her haircut. You know, what a nice haircut you have. And she'd had chemotherapy, and it was growing back, and how nice your hair looks today. And then she said, I'm going to be the cutest little corpse. Just like that. Which you would think would be morbid. But you see, her spirit had already begun to loosen the ties. She was already saying goodbye to herself. Now, when Jesus lived and walked among people, he inhabited a physical body. He was a person, a living person. But the difference between him and all those around him was that he was aware not only of that physical being, but everything else that was included in the potential of his own consciousness. As he himself said, I go where you cannot follow me, because I go back to the Father. I know myself as the Father. He is your Father as much as he is mine, but I know that, and that is something you have yet to learn. So the power that came through him, all of his disciples naturally associated with that what must have been a beautiful face and a beautiful voice and a beautiful manner. We know from the living saints of our time how that power can come through, and how just even a moment in that company can be so transforming. Because not only does that being have the awareness of his own consciousness, but when he looks at everyone else, the unifying reality of his divinity is also recognized in us, and the power of his conviction or her conviction that what he is looking at is not a limited being as we call ourselves, but the living presence of God himself. And this was what John experienced so powerfully that he shed his own name. What he experienced on a continual basis was how much Jesus loved him. Now, there's a part of us that thinks, well, isn't that egocentric? You know, Jesus loved me. It's a very touching story that I love to contemplate. Sister Gyanamata, who was the most advanced disciple of Paramhansa Yogananda, she wrote a letter to her guru. She wrote these beautiful letters to her master with such sweet intimacy. You know, we have this thought that in the presence of the great masters, we would be so... we must stand back and sort of hold back our hearts. But the Bible tells us, one of the most touching stories in the Bible is when Jesus talks about he was there with his disciples and they were having dinner, and a woman comes in, Mary Magdalene, it is presumed. She comes in and she has this expensive bottle of rich perfume, and she kneels in front of Jesus and she pours the perfume over his feet, and then she takes her long hair and she washes his feet with her hair. Now, it's very, very difficult to conceive of something more intimate. You know, to be kneeling in front of him, to be washing his feet, and not content merely with a towel or a rag or a pitcher, but she takes her own person and she uses it to rub his feet. And you can see, even in the story in the Bible, Judas is the one who articulates it. But can you imagine everyone just sort of standing back just a little bit? You know, really, this isn't done in the best circles, you know. Don't you think this is a little excessive? But the Master, Jesus himself, when others criticized her, said, let her be. You know, she who loves much, much is forgiven. What he saw in her and she, Mary, saw. She didn't see anything. She didn't see the other men in the room. She didn't see the propriety of the situation. She didn't see anything. She had one self-definition, and that self-definition was her relationship to her master. That's who she had become, just as John had become. And it's not merely, and this is one of the most powerful lessons that all of these stories about Jesus give us, it's not merely a question of what we sort of in our enthusiasm manage to give, because so often, even in that giving, we're still holding on to this sense of self. Look at me, I'm such a giving person. Look at me, I'm such a generous person. Or even more subtly, look at me, I'm such a worthy person. because look how much I can give. But you see, what really binds us above all things is that sense of self. It's that holding on to that little bit that says, I am separate. And only in complete self-forgetfulness could this woman come into this public place where he was dining with so many and just without consciousness of anything, except, oh, here he is, and let me express to him my love for him. And what was Jesus' response? The only possible response was to give back to her in full measure what she was capable of receiving. You see, that's why John always was able to say that, because he had given up all sense of himself at all. He'd lost, as I say, even his own name. The only reality he had was this relationship to Jesus. And so in the Easter story, Mary Magdalene, at the first moment when the Jewish law allowed her to, because he was crucified as the Sabbath was descending, and they had to hurriedly wrap him quickly and put him into the tomb, because for the period of the Sabbath from sundown till the dawn of the first day of the week, they couldn't do any work, and it was so strongly imbued in them that there was no possibility of violating that, even for such an extraordinary event as this. But before the dawn had even come, at the first possible moment that Mary Magdalene had to go attend to now what was she assumed was the dead body of the one that she loved, she rushed to the tomb, and she found it open. And her only first thought, and you know, we think that we would be so enlightened in such a moment, but her first thought was, oh yes, he promised to raise the temple in 3 days, and of course he was referring to his body, and now he's resurrected. You know, it was just the response of love. They've taken him away. Now they've not only killed him, but now they've desecrated his body, and even that little is denied to me. And she goes running back to get the help of the men. What shall we do? What shall we do? They've taken his body away. And all she can think of is just her grief. Isn't life like that sometimes? Swamiji says the reason that people speak of hell being eternal is because when you're suffering, that's what it feels like. It's not really that God would love us so little as to damn us without possibility of redemption. Such a thought is only the thought of the limited human mind that itself carries its vengeance to such extremes, but it's unworthy of the infinite. But when we suffer in that moment, imagine the agony of those days after Jesus, with such hope, they had given their hearts to him, and you realize the whole situation of the Jewish people at that time, they were so oppressed. And here, the completely incarnated power and glory of the infinite had dwelt among them, and all of their prophecies had said that he would liberate them. And the mind, identified as it is with the body, with human life, with politics, with worldly power, just imagines that this power is going to manifest in the way that I want it to manifest. But Jesus had such a much deeper lesson to imagine. I mean, even one lifetime, we get so organized, we get to be king, we get to be president, we get to be wealthy. How many times in a lifetime do our fortunes rise and fall and rise and fall and rise and fall, and everything is just as we expect it to be, and then something beyond our control takes it away? Or the most powerful person grows old and feeble. You know, you see these great dictators who've expressed their will to create havoc on others, and then they're, you know, just think of the man in Iraq, whatever his name was, you know, hiding like an animal in the ground, just taken out of the ground like that. He'd been so powerful, and then he was nothing. And then he dies, and it's just all a memory. You know? But we know in ourselves that there's something more enduring that is our own nature. We sense it. That's why we're drawn to these glorious stories. That's why the presence and the power of these great teachers inspires us like nothing else can inspire us. And that's why this story of Christ just goes on and on and on and on. because there he was. Everything that we fear was inflicted upon him. Everything. His own disciples, for the most part, ran away from him. He was tortured. He was killed in the most appalling manner. And then Mary Magdalene, who remained loyal despite all of that, because even though all of these realities were true to her, there was something still that was deeper in her. That's what spirituality really is. It's not about imposing on the outside, just sort of getting ourselves organized and managing to assume a new identity. This is how I behave in polite society. I've learned how to have the right kind of manners. I've overcome my accent and now I can speak perfect English. I've learned the right grammar. I know what the diplomacy is when I go to these countries. These are all just externally imposed ways of behavior. The real power of the spiritual path is this gradual redefinition from the inside. In the Bhagavad Gita, it says, everything that is to the worldly man, what is day to the worldly man, to the man of material thinking, is night to the one who seeks the inner truth. And what is day to the man of inner truth is night to the worldly person. You know, Jesus appeared to have been an absolute failure. I mean, what could be more of a failure than him? He didn't even know how to extricate himself from Pontius Pilate. Pontius Pilate says, "Don't you understand? Just give me a few of the right words and I can let you go." And Jesus answered so magnificently. First he said, "You have no power over me." Pontius Pilate's trying to say, "Don't you understand I have power?" Jesus just looks at him and says, "You have no power over me except what is given to you from God." He said, and then Pontius Pilate asked him, "Are you a king?" Because the priests had accused him of claiming to be the king of the Jewish people and had threatened Pontius Pilate. "This is a threat to the order if this king is allowed." So Pontius Pilate says, "Are you a king?" Jesus answers so beautifully, "If I were a king," he said, "my kingdom is not of this world." He said, "If my kingdom were of this world, my men would have fought to keep me from being taken." I think about that. For some reason, that phrase this Easter has really struck me. "My men would have fought to keep me from being taken." There's a certain nobility in that, even actually. And in fact, what's so interesting in the Bible is that Peter did fight. When they came to arrest Jesus at the Garden of Gethsemane, Peter carried a sword, the Bible says, and he drew his sword and he attacked one of the guards, because Peter's mind was still of two realities. Here is Jesus, the physical body. These men want to take this physical body away. I will put my life on the line for him. And there is a certain nobility in that. But then Jesus said, "No, this is not the way my destiny is set to go. This is the way you think." And he even says it to Pontius Pilate, "If I were that kind of a king, my men would have fought." He said, "But my power is of the Lord, of a completely different order. Even now," he says, "legions of angels could rescue me," which is to say, don't kid yourself, your worldly power will come and go. You know, Pontius Pilate is only known because of the ignominious role he played in the death of Jesus. Otherwise, his name would just be long since forgotten. But the power of Jesus perseveres. But you know why it perseveres? Perseveres because of souls like Mary and Peter and the disciple whom Jesus loved. Because, you see, it's through human action and through human memory, and above all, through human attunement. Swamiji said something so dear once. He said God would give so many gifts to this world, so many things that God would will as blessings to this world are left unexpressed for lack of a human instrument to bring them forth. Because what became of Jesus' teaching was the power that he planted in the individual consciousness of those who received his love. I mean, think what John did with the gospel that he wrote and the book of Revelations, which was the experience, his deep, deep experience of the presence of Christ within him. Through that, he's touched millions beyond count. The Gospel of John, you just read it over and over, and as soon as you pick up that book, you know that you're in the presence of something completely other. You can read thousands of pages in the libraries of the world, and still when you open them up, you don't feel that you're in the presence as you are when you're reading that gospel. And why are you in that presence? Because John himself, when he wrote it, was in that presence. And why was John able to be in that presence? Because he had completely redefined himself from the inside out. I am not even a person with a name. I am the one whom Jesus loved. And Mary Magdalene, who stood at the foot of the cross when Jesus was being crucified, at great peril to herself. They didn't know whether these powerful authorities were going to sweep through and take them all. Even Peter, as Jesus had predicted three times that terrible night after Jesus was arrested, three times people said to him, Peter had protested to Jesus at the Last Supper, "Wherever you're going, I'll go with you. I would lay down my life for you." And Jesus, who loved Peter so greatly that he wanted him to know that I know what's going to happen, said, "Oh, is that so? You know, just, oh, I say three times before this night is over, you will deny that you even knew me." Imagine being that disciple, being told that. He's just made this great protestation, you know, of who he is. And even when they come like a worldly man, he pulls out his sword to fight. But then the fear comes upon him. And he goes where Jesus is being held prisoner. And the doorkeeper says to him, "Aren't you one of his disciples?" "No, no, I don't know him." He's standing warming his hands. And someone says, "Didn't I see you with him?" "No, no, not me." Finally, again, a servant says, "Weren't you in the garden with him?" "No," Peter says. But he repented of it and became, of course, great. And when Jesus resurrected and came back in the Acts of the Apostles, three times now, Jesus says to Peter, "Do you love me?" "Yes, Lord, I love you." Then Jesus said to him, "Feed my sheep." In other words, give my consciousness to others. And then again, Jesus said, "Do you love me?" Peter said, "Yes, Lord, I love you." It was as if the karma had to be balanced. And then it says Peter became distressed that Jesus didn't believe him. One more time, Jesus said, "Do you love me?" Peter said, "Yes, Lord, I do." "Feed my sheep." Feed my sheep with what? Fish, bread, you know, lettuce, cabbage? What can we feed? You give out like that, what does that do for people? Death will come, disappointment will come. The only thing of everlasting value is what Jesus himself had, which was the power to transcend it all. Transcend it all, not merely with the worldly sword, but with the unlimited love and understanding of the human condition. Even as Jesus was being crucified, he said, "Father, forgive them, for they know not what they do." Think of that. Just think of looking at the person who has wronged you the most in your life. Just whatever that is, we're all misunderstood. Think of the person who has wronged you the most. And don't just think about, "Oh, in my magnanimity, I will forgive you." You know, the forgiveness is a little tricky sometimes, because sometimes it's I who am forgiving. But just looking at it and not even seeing that a wrong has been committed. But all that you see is the divine struggling to express itself perfectly and becoming a little bit cracked on the shoals of misunderstanding. You see, it's all from the inside out. Over the many years that I've known Swami Kriyananda, who has been my personal personification of the spiritual teachings, the greatest lesson for me, and it's come very slowly, is to gradually understand this is not something he tries to be. This has been a gradual redefinition from the inside out. You know, we don't have to work hard to love if we recognize that love simply is all there is. If we recognize our own frailty, you know, John's complete acceptance that Jesus loved him was to a very great extent a deep recognition of his own frailty. That's one of the hardest things to recognize. I've observed that in myself and in others. If I can't be perfect, then at least I'll be terrible. You know, we love to just rail against ourselves. "Oh, how I've failed, how I never get this together, and I never get that together. I often have to say to people, you know, the problem is, you're really not even that bad. You're just sort of like all the rest of us, just kind of in the mediocre middle. That's the hardest thing, just to accept that we're just ordinary. Even our sufferings are not really very special, you know? That we're just, as Swamiji puts it so sweetly, somewhere on the spectrum, the ego on the spectrum, working for salvation. We're just trying hard to get free. And we make such a mess of it. But it doesn't really matter. Because let me just close with this one last thought. Let me try to think how to say this. You know, so many of the affirmations that Master has written, and so many of the things that we say, I am one with the Infinite Spirit. From joy I came, for joy I live. In sacred joy I melt again. A tiny bubble of laughter, I have become the sea of mirth itself. These are some of the beautiful sayings on the walls above us from Master's poem, Samadhi. I'm very happy to say that as I've gotten older, I've gotten less dumb. Swamiji once complimented me. I didn't consider it much of a compliment at the time, but now I do. He once complimented me by saying, I forced him to compliment me. So he said, you're a lot less confused than you used to be. Which I really considered to be damning with faint praise at the time. But later on I realized, I am a lot less confused than I used to be. Master asks of us very great things, and in my youth, I used to resist them. I used to be too practical, of course, from joy. I mean, yes, maybe some people from joy, they came, you know, but I came from maybe a pool of giggles, maybe, you know? And I would sort of disallow that possibility and work more from the outside in. Here I am, Asha, and I'm gradually getting better. But over the years, I've finally began to hear what the Masters say to us. And what the Masters say is, your true nature is perfect. And all you have to do is expand that bubble of perfection and break this sort of dried mud of wrong understanding. And it's so different to think of ourselves as sort of this one gradually working to get better than it is to think of ourselves as the perfect one gradually emerging from the confusion. And even still, you might still be at just the same place. It's not like it makes you, you know, anything puffed up that you're not, or makes you unrealistic about yourself. You're still just, you know, about the same proportion of good and bad. But it's so different to constantly liberate yourself from suffering by remembering that I am part of this vast ocean of spirit, and all I have to do is improve my knowing. And then what it also gives us is it gives us this deep, unified sense of compassion with everyone else that we meet. Because who are they except just the same bubble of spirit encased in some stupid, self-created self-definition that just limits our understanding? You know, every human being longs so deeply for kindness, for love, for security. How many people are really willing to forget themselves enough to give it? That's one of the reasons John's self-definition is so sweet. I am the disciple whom Jesus loved. Imagine, because it's true, imagine that you too are the disciple that Jesus loved. Just think, you are the disciple that Master loves. You are the disciple that Divine Mother loves. You are the struggling devotee that is completely and unconditionally accepted. Now, where is there in that any space for sorrow, unkindness, impatience, fear? Perfect love casts out all fear. Be we, therefore, as Jesus was, as John was with Jesus, those disciples whom Jesus loved. Isn't that an extraordinary message? Let us run with Mary Magdalene to the tomb as soon as the light comes and discover there within ourselves the risen Christ, the liberated soul, the freedom from all external limitations. From joy I came, for joy I live. In sacred joy, I melt. God bless you.